This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back from vacation. Thanks to Barbara Bogue for hosting while I was gone. Well, now that I'm back and rested, what's our subject of the day? Pain. My guest, Dr. Frank Vrtacic, is a neurosurgeon and the author of Why We Hurt, The Natural History of Pain. It examines the biological nature of chronic pain and the best ways of treating it. Dr. Vrtacic has treated many nightmarish pain problems during his career, including traumatic amputations, ruptured spinal discs, fractured vertebrae, diabetic neuropathy, migraines, and belligerent kidney stones. He says that when he's alone with the patient, it feels as though three entities are in that room: the patient, the doctor, and the pain.
When you're dealing with a patient, particularly a patient with chronic severe pain, the pain becomes almost a personality in itself. It becomes almost an alter ego for that person. It begins to control their lives, tell them what they can do, what they can't do, whether they can work, whether they can't work. And so you almost feel as if it becomes a separate personality that you have to deal with. And that's not so much true for the person who comes in with an acute pain of 1 or 2 weeks duration, but somebody who's lived with pain for months or years.
And it sounds like a lot of the patients who you work with are terrified that they will live their whole life in pain, that the pain is never going to stop.
Yes, I think that's the human dimension of pain. I differentiate between pain and suffering. Animals feel pain. Humans impose a psychic dimension of on their pain, which we know as suffering. And suffering is pain coupled with hopelessness, despair, the feeling that you may never be well again.
Now, as you point out in your book, pain is not something we can empirically measure. And all you can do to understand your patient's pain and the source of the pain, you have to ask for descriptions of the pain. How bad is it? What kind of pain is it? And so your understanding of a patient's pain is going to have to depend on their ability to describe it well.
That's correct. There have been a number of attempts to try and quantify pain. You show people a scale, a bar graph, and say, you know, this is no pain and that's maximum pain. Where would you fit? But the bottom line is that we cannot objectively measure the degree of physical pain that someone's having, at least not yet. That's something that may be in the on the horizon in the next 10 or 20 years. But right now, you're right, we're totally at the mercy of the person to tell us how bad their pain is and how it affects their lives. I cannot go and do a test or run their head through a scanner or do some other blood work or something to say, yes, you are having a large degree of pain, or no, you are not having the degree of pain that warrants this treatment or that treatment.
So what are the things you're listening for when someone's describing their pain?
Well, you're listening for not only the magnitude of the pain, but you also have to find how that pain is impacting their lives. And so someone, for example, may tell you that I have a severe degree of pain. And when you question them, you find that they're not taking pain medication, they're golfing 4 or 5 times a week, and so on. And you see that perhaps the level of that complaint does not seem to be impacting their lives enough for you to embark upon what might be a more dangerous or risky therapies to cure that pain. And likewise, other people may minimize in the office their degree of pain and say, well, I'm not bothered that much. But then you ask them, well, what are you doing? Well, I used to golf all the time. I stopped doing that. I have to go to work part-time now. And you begin to realize that this pain they may verbalize in the office is not severe is really making a major difference in their quality of life and may warrant a more aggressive therapy to try and get them back to a normal quality of life.
Let's talk about some of the techniques of dealing with pain. You say, for instance, that during the late 1800s and the first half of the 1900s, many physicians thought that chronic pain could be cured by cutting the nerves that were transmitting the pain. Why was that the theory, and what happened in the practice?
In that era, the era of the 19th century, early 20th century, when all we had was aspirin and morphine, there really weren't many modalities to treat severe pain other than some drastic surgical methods. And so, for example, if someone had facial pain or chronic dental pain, the treatment was to just cut the nerve that went to the face or cut the nerves in the jaw that supplied the teeth in the feeling that, well, it was better to have numbness than pain. And they knew that the physicians and patients knew that they were trading complete sensory loss for the theoretical removal of their pain. What we learned and what we still see today when people try those therapies is that two things. One is that the numbness often isn't better than the pain. It becomes worse than the pain in terms of just the feeling of numbness that you get. And the second thing is a more dreaded complication, which is known as anesthesia dolorosa or painful numbness, in which your body plays a very cruel trick on you and replaces the sensation of numbness with pain. And so you get pain in a body part that you no longer can feel. So example, phantom limb pain, where you don't have a limb at all and you still feel severe pain in that limb.
One of the case studies that you write about in your book is a man who you treated who was in a bad motorcycle accident. And I think it was the nerves to his arm that were severed. And he had terrible, like excruciating pain in an arm that he could no longer use or feel. And as you say, it's such a cruel irony. Can you explain a little more why, when nerves are severed, the pain should be excruciating as opposed to you feeling the absence of anything?
The nervous system is wired in such a way that you don't have just a nerve go straight from the skin, say, to the brain. There are several intermediary nerve cells in between, such as in the spinal cord and in the brainstem. So it's almost like a bucket brigade type arrangement where one nerve passes a sensation from the skin to the spinal cord nerves then pass it on to the brainstem, and the brainstem pass it on into our consciousness. The problem when you cut a peripheral nerve is that you're only removing one nerve cell in that chain of command. And so subsequently, the nerve cells that are upstream, such as in the spinal cord or the brain, suddenly find themselves without anything to do. And sometimes they don't like that. They don't like being deprived of anything to do. And so they begin just making things up, hallucinating, so to speak, and feeding static upstream into the brain. I use the analogy of a television set that if you have a cable television set, if the cable goes out and you're deprived of a meaningful input to the set, the screen doesn't go blank. It still projects a staticky white picture because that's what it's designed to do. It's designed to keep working even without an input. And in the spinal cord, when it does that, it transmits static to the brain. And unfortunately, that static is perceived in our consciousness as terrible pain. And so it's really a form of sensory hallucination that's manufactured within the higher centers, particularly in the spinal cord. So the brain does not like, and the spinal cord does not like a vacuum. They will fill it up with something, and if you cut a peripheral nerve and you have no meaningful input from a limb, it will replace it with pain, and it's a misfortunate way our body is wired, that pain is sort of a default sensation when there is no other meaningful sensation to perceive.
What technique do you have as a surgeon to deal with this kind of phantom pain?
Well, it depends on where the pain is coming from. In the example, the case study in the book, coming from the upper extremity, the arm, a procedure was used on him known as a Dres lesion, a dorsal root entry zone lesion, in which the nerve cells in the spinal cord that are hallucinating or producing the static are physically destroyed with a hot electric probe. It's a very risky operation, but for people who have experienced this type of anesthesia dolorosa, their pain is so severe that they are willing to take the risk and actually let somebody enter their spinal cord and attempt to destroy the pain-generating neurons inside the spinal cord itself.
How do you find which are the right neurons?
You know anatomically where the right neurons are because of their location in the so-called dorsal root entry zone, where the sensory nerve enters the back of the spinal cord. Right at that level, approximately 2 millimeters or so deep to that level, there are located the pain-generating neurons. And so you have an electrode that basically just has a 2 or 3 millimeter of active probe exposed at the tip. The rest is insulated, and you just manually insert it into the spinal cord at that location, and you use a electric current generator to actually coagulate that part of the spinal cord. It's a delicate surgery. It has risks. But again, the fact that people are willing to undergo this procedure shows the magnitude of the pain that they're in.
So it doesn't work to sever a nerve to stop pain, but it can work to destroy the nerve that's causing the pain.
Yes, you will notice a temporary reduction in pain, just like when we have a shot of xylocaine or novocaine in our jaw to have a root canal. We don't feel that pain. We do have an uncomfortable sensation of numbness in our jaw. You will get a temporary success, say, of cutting a nerve and feel better for perhaps 4 months, 6 months, 9 months before eventually the static information begins to arise and provide the sensation of anesthesia dolorosa or painful numbness. But the fact that you do get a temporary relief means that severing nerves is still an option in people who have types of pain in which, say, malignant pain, where their life expectancy is less than a year and they're not likely to develop the anesthesia dolorosa. Those sorts of nerve severing operations may still be useful, but they're not useful for a type of benign pain like facial pain in somebody who has a normal life expectancy. You're just asking for trouble down the road. You're going to get a temporary success and a potential long-term disaster.
My guest is Dr. Frank Vrtacic. He's a neurosurgeon and the author of the new book, Why We Hurt, The Natural History of Pain. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is neurosurgeon Dr. Frank Vrtacic. He specializes in treating chronic pain. His new book is called Why We Hurt, The Natural History of Pain. Let's talk about the cause of a very common form of back pain, herniated discs and degenerated discs. First of all, maybe you could describe the difference between these two disc problems.
A degenerated disc is a normal aging process within the disc itself. The best way to understand what's happening in a disc is to consider what's happening in the lens of our eyes. It seems funny to compare the two, but structurally they're very similar. The lens of the eye and the disc in the back, they're basically a fibrous capsule with a watery gelatinous center. And as we get older, the elasticity of those structures and their water content tends to go down. They basically start drying out and become stiffer. We see the same thing happening in the skin. That's why as people get older, they use moisturizing creams and so on. So you're seeing a general water loss, increased stiffness of the tissues, which in the eye is manifested as difficulty reading and needing reading glasses. In the lower back, you will see it on an MRI scan that certain of the discs actually begin to lose water and they begin to lose height and lose their elasticity and bulge. So you will hear the term a bulging disc or degenerated disc or deteriorated disc applied to that normal aging process. In most people, the vast majority of people, it is a painless process so that most people with degenerated discs will not have pain. And in a general population over the age of 40, fully 50% of people will have those on an MRI scan if you just pull them off the street or off a tennis court and say, we want to do an MRI scan for a study. That has been done, and they are very ubiquitous in the population. A herniated disc is a different matter altogether. It's when the disc has become so dried out and so stiff that some event actually leads the disc to fracture and part of the disc to displace or to herniate out of its normal position in the spine and impact the nerves, causing nerve pain or a condition commonly known as sciatica.
So you say that when you have a herniated disc, part of the disc can actually break free and wedge itself against a nerve, and that could be what's responsible for the serious pain?
In people with leg pain, that's the case. There's a great misconception that if you have back pain, and back pain is so common in the population, 50 to 70 million people at one time are going to be complaining of back pain. Back pain alone is not a sign of a herniated disc. It's nerve pain, pain in the leg, numbness in the leg. Those sorts of symptoms are going to be what you see with an actual herniation of the disc. So there's a lot of confusion. Most back pain, just pure mechanical back pain, is not really related to anything going on in the discs itself. It is the syndrome of sciatica with the pain shooting down the leg that is more indicative of disc disease.
What kind of back problems do you most often see in your practice?
In a general neurosurgical practice, you see just about all types of back conditions because a lot of the internists are under the same misconception if somebody comes to them and with severe back pain that they should be seen by a specialist and go to a neurosurgeon. Really, the only surgically treatable conditions are the ones in which the disc is actually displaced and impinging the nerves. So in most surgical practices, we will see a heavy preponderance of people with an actual herniated disc, but we still see a fair number of people with non-surgical mechanical back pain.
Who do you recommend surgery for? Like what are the problems that are fixable now with surgery that you're most confident about?
The standard indications for back operation, and those are evolving somewhat depending upon which specialty you talk to. The standard indication is for somebody with a displaced disc, where the disc is actually ruptured out of its normal compartment in the spine, is impinging a nerve, and is causing a degree of pain and disability, which the person who is going to undergo the surgery considers is worth having an operation for. A lot of my patients are taken aback when I tell them that for most people, having a back operation is similar to having a facelift, in the sense that they come to me and ask, they say, should I have this operation? It's sort of similar to going to a plastic surgeon and ask them, do you think I should have a facelift? It is really not the surgeon's responsibility or domain to tell that person if their quality of life is so harmed by this disease that they should have surgery for it. Because most back operations are a quality of life operation. They're not intended to make you live longer or be healthier. They're intended to make you better faster from a degenerative disc condition. Whether you choose to have surgery or not is purely at the discretion of the person. Some people will have a back operation the day after they have pain. They don't like even a day or two of pain. Other people will not let you operate on them even if they're incapacitated for 9 or 10 months. And neither person is right or wrong. It's a matter of personal preference.
I was surprised to read in your book that smoking can worsen spinal problems. Why is that?
Because smoking in general is a insult to the small blood vessels throughout the body and tends to accelerate the aging process. And I think in the general lay public has the idea of smoking affecting your heart and affecting your lungs. But you can tell in the skin of somebody who's a long-term smoker, if you look at somebody who's 65 or 70 who's been a heavy smoker all their life, and compare that to a person who has not been, you can see a definite acceleration of the aging process in the skin. And that is true in all the connective tissues of the body. That's not just speculation. Studies have shown that the rate of disc degeneration in smokers is higher than non-smokers. The outcome of spinal surgery, particularly fusions, is much poorer in people who are smokers. The return to work after back injuries in smokers is not as quick or as certain as people who are non-smokers. So there is a definite influence of cigarette smoke on the integrity of the spine, as it also affects other tissues of the body just as well.
Do you find that people's personalities change if you're able to alleviate the pain? You know, that pain changes personality and the relief of pain changes personality?
Oh, I think that definitely. There's probably no worse effect on someone's psyche or personality to have a chronic background drone of pain affecting you. I think that We know, most people know from their own experience, just if they're having pain of a flu for several weeks, how that affects their attitude towards life and towards their fellow coworkers, their family. And yes, you do see a marked change in people for the better if you can silence that constant background drone of pain.
Dr. Frank Vrtacic is the author of Why We Hurt, The Natural History of Pain. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Frank Vrtacic. He's a neurosurgeon and the author of the new book, Why We Hurt, The Natural History of Pain. The book examines some of the latest ways of treating chronic pain, including alternative therapies and prescription drugs. What are some of the new drugs on the market that you're most optimistic about in terms of their treatment of pain?
I think the best medications that I've seen in my own practice are not new drugs, but they're new ways of delivering drugs. Specifically, the long-acting narcotics, such as MS-Contin and a variety of other proprietary medications that deliver narcotics over a much more sustained release so that people get a longer duration of pain relief without having to take medications as frequently and without having short-term rush or buzz that they get with taking shorter-acting narcotics. So long-acting narcotic medications, narcotic patches, which again give a better delivery system, a more long-lasting delivery system. That's been a big advance in the last 10 years. Of course, the more recent development of the so-called COX-2 or cyclooxygenase 2 inhibitors, proprietary names such as Vioxx. These are medications that are like aspirin, but they target only the pathways that deal with pain. They do not affect the stomach as severely. And in my practice, that has been a big benefit for a number of patients. Anti-inflammatory medications come out. New ones are coming out all the time. It becomes difficult for most practicing physicians to keep up with the different brand names, and people are always coming into my office saying they're on this medication or that medication, which I have yet to hear of. But I think what's most important is new ways of delivering the medications, new ways of delivering old medications rather than the development of new medications.
One of those new ways, I think, has to do with, say, certain pain medications delivered through a nasal spray. Why is that effective?
Well, that is effective because, again, these are ways of delivering quickly. Higher doses of medication, especially for diseases such as migraine, where speed is of the essence, or trigeminal neuralgia, where people may have a sudden flare-up within a matter of 30 minutes to 60 minutes of their pain. And so taking conventional oral medications might take too long to work, may take 2 or 3 hours to reach their maximal effect. So certainly for entities such as migraine, where you may get a warning that you're going to have a headache and you need to obtain relief or a level of drug faster than what an oral pill might give you, things such as nasal sprays or even carrying injectable medications with you are going to provide you faster relief than taking a pill.
Some doctors say now that we should be more liberal in our use of narcotics for people who are terminally ill, that there's no reason to worry about them becoming addicted because they're not worried about the future, and there's no reason that they should die in pain. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that there's a general trend to be more liberal with narcotics in general. And the term addiction in pain medicine it doesn't have the same meaning as it does, say, in recreational drug use. If someone you're clearly convinced is in severe pain, their addiction, and you're using narcotics to treat the pain, their chance of addiction is not that high. So people have been more aggressive not only in malignant pain syndromes such as cancer, but also in benign pain syndromes such as chronic back pain after a failed back operation and so on. My own belief is, yes, your first obligation as a physician is to ease suffering, even perhaps a higher calling than prolonging life. And so that's your main goal. The problem is that there's a misconception in the public that we have achieved a level of technology that allows us to ease someone's pain completely and yet not obtund them or cause an alteration in their mental status. And so, yes, we can take almost anybody in severe pain and render them pain-free, but at a cost that they may not want to pay, namely being completely obtunded. So we have to continuously walk that fine line of giving them pain relief and yet reducing their quality of life so severely that it's just not worth using the medications. And that's where different means of narcotic delivery have been developed, such as instilling the narcotic directly into the spinal fluid itself, for example, or using the more long duration narcotic pills or narcotic patches instead of conventional high doses of oral narcotics. But yes, I believe that we need to be more aggressive, but I think the public is still under somewhat of a misconception that we can take away all the pain of a terminally ill patient without causing them to have severe mental status problems, and we're just not at that level of technology yet.
Now, you mentioned some of the new drug delivery systems that you're optimistic about. What about some of the alternative approaches to dealing with pain? Let's take something like acupuncture and magnetic therapy. Starting with acupuncture, have you seen much success with that?
I've had a few patients see success with that. That's true. And there's acupuncture and its needleless cousin, acupressure. I think that's the latter is probably in more widespread use. In terms of, yes, I have seen results from that as well as from a variety of alternative treatments. I think that the main thing in remembering dealing with alternative treatments that if you have a chronic benign pain, if it works for you, it works. And I give an example in the book of a man who came to me convinced that wearing magnets in his back brace cured him of his back pain. I can't argue with him. I can't quote him any study or any scientific treatise on the role of magnetic fields in the human body that's going to convince him otherwise. And I told him that if magnets made him better, I'm happy for him. Use them. They work for you, if they take your pain away, then use them. And some people will say, well, that's just a placebo effect. But the bottom line is, if somebody's in pain and they employ a therapy that is not particularly dangerous, is not going to bankrupt them, and it helps them, then I don't think I or any other physician should criticize them for seeking that out, particularly if I don't have anything else to offer them short of potentially dangerous surgery or narcotics.
No, I mean, acupuncture has a very long history that many people have read about. What about magnets? You're seeing these little magnet kits sold in even department stores now. Is there anything behind it medically that can be explained?
Well, magnet therapy is probably as old as acupuncture, and it dates back all the way to the 16th century when people, particularly Paracelsus, the alchemist, felt that magnets could withdraw out evil humors and draw out pain. And so it's sort of magnet therapy has been around for a long time. Even the chiropractic, the school of chiropractic back in the turn of the century started out as a school of magnetic therapy. And when people didn't really buy into the magnetic therapy, they began utilizing spinal manipulation in addition to magnetic therapy. Is there anything to it? It's hard to imagine scientifically what could be the benefit of wearing, say, a ceramic magnet. The penetration of that magnetic field is only about 3 or 4 millimeters. That's why if you hang up a piece of paper on a refrigerator, you can hang with a ceramic magnet. You can put up one piece of paper. You put up 2 or 3 pieces of paper, the magnet will not hold. It just does not have the strength or the depth of penetration to go more than 2 or 3 millimeters. So to wear a magnet, you're basically not really having much of an effect below the level of, say, 2 or 3 millimeters into the skin.
Do you often recommend your patients to chiropractors, and have your patients had much success with chiropractors?
I do, because if I think they have a mechanical back pain, or mechanical neck pain, meaning that it's not due to a fracture or a large herniated disc or something that is going to potentially require surgery. They come in with just back or neck pain of a fairly short duration. There's good evidence that chiropractic manipulation is every bit as good as conventional physical therapy or surgery in terms of getting people over an acute episode of mechanical spinal pain. And so, yes, I will refer them to a chiropractor. But most of my patients don't need me to refer them to a chiropractor. I would say that probably nowadays three out of four of my patients have already been to a chiropractor, and the chiropractor sent them to us. So I think that there is a value to chiropractic, whether there's a value to long-term chiropractic, people who've been or going and being manipulated three times a week for 2 or 3 years, there's not good evidence that that is doing anything. But for a pain of, say, 3 or 4 weeks duration, mechanical pain, there is good evidence that they help people. And yes, with my own patients, I've seen a good response with chiropractic if it's done on the properly chosen person and it's done with a reputable chiropractor who knows when to treat and when to bail out and send that person to a surgeon or to an allopathic physician such as myself when the chiropractic fails.
My guest is Dr. Frank Vrtacek. He's a neurosurgeon and the author of the new book, Why We Hurt, The Natural History of Pain. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Frank Vrtacek, the author of Why We Hurt, The Natural History of Pain. I want to ask you about cancer pain. I'm wondering if you think that cancer pain is medically different than other forms of pain, if there's any unique qualities about it?
Cancer pain there's not really a unique physical component to cancer pain. There's a unique emotional component to it, but the physical pain is basically similar pain to what you get with any other similar disease. For example, if you have a metastasis of a breast cancer tumor in your hip and your hip fractures, you have severe pain. The pain will not be any different in character or magnitude than somebody who broke their hip in a motorcycle accident. So there is not a unique physical component to the pain. But there's a unique mental component in the sense that people with cancer pain know the significance of that pain, and that tends to alter their perception of that pain. If you break your hip in a motorcycle accident, you know you will get better from that is a treatable temporary thing. The cancer pain patient knows that once they begin to have pain, that may not end for them until the end of their life. And that does put a completely different perspective on it that outweighs any of the biological aspects of the pain itself.
How will that affect how you treat cancer pain?
People with cancer pain, because they tend to have a shorter life expectancy, we can be more aggressive with use of certain surgical and medical therapies that we could not, for example, in somebody with benign pain. So in that respect, the life expectancy of somebody does factor into how aggressive you can be. We talked earlier about, you can sever nerves in people for benign pain. That may lead to problems 2 or 3 years down the road. In somebody whose life expectancy may not be 2 or 3 years, you can be more aggressive with those sorts of surgical procedures. But I think you just need a different degree of empathy for somebody who has cancer pain compared to somebody who has benign pain.
As you point out, some people try to find meaning in their pain. Explain what you mean by that.
Humans are unique in that we can find meaning in suffering. We can tolerate suffering if it has some purpose in our lives. The example I use was Sir Edmund Hillary. I went to a talk by Sir Edmund Hillary talking about the night he spent just below the summit of Everest before he made the final assault. And he said it was the most miserable experience of his life. They did not have enough oxygen. They were, for the two of them, most of the time they were short of breath. The temperatures were extremely cold. They had nothing to eat. And he said it was just absolute torture that night. And you ask yourself, well, why would someone voluntarily do that? Why would someone voluntarily put themselves in a position of being miserable. And he did it because of the reward, which was to attain a goal, to climb the highest mountain on earth, so that we as humans will, as human beings, will tolerate pain if we think that there is something at the end of the road that is beneficial or worthwhile. And so I tell some patients, if they don't have any success in medically treating their pain, try and find some good that come out of it. For example, to counsel other people who have similar problems, lecture about their pain, join organizations, do something, anything to try and find a positive aspect to their pain, to make it seem like that is something that is not worthwhile, but something that has a silver lining. It's very difficult to do, but some of my patients have managed to do just that.
Dr. Frank Vrtacic is my guest, and he's a neurosurgeon specializing in dealing with chronic pain. He's also the author of the new book, Why We Hurt, The Natural History of Pain. You've had migraines since childhood. Is that one of the reasons why you went into pain-related surgery and medicine?
Yes, I have had migraines, and I guess anybody's own medical background influences them to some degree in becoming a physician. And I can't say specifically that having migraines made me become a neurosurgeon, but it has certainly given me an insight of what it's like to be incapacitated by pain, particularly when you're incapacitated by pain that no one else can see and there is no physical correlate to it. Migraine is probably the epitome of the type of pain syndrome which you don't get a lot of sympathy for. Everyone feels they get headaches. They just don't understand why your headaches are so much out of the ordinary from anyone else. But if you have migraines, you know that the degree that you can be incapacitated by pain, to the point where you're having pain so severe that if you had to get up and run to save your life from a burning building, you might have some doubts whether you would even bother to do it at that time. And that's how severe it can get. So I think it's provided me with some empathy into how severely incapacitating pain can be. Fortunately for me, like most men, I have managed to outgrow my migraines over the last 10 or 12 years, so they've not been much of a problem for me. That many people are not so lucky.
Yeah, you were told when you were starting off in medicine, what about if the migraine comes on you while you're in the operating room? What would you do? Is this really the right choice for your profession? Did that ever happen?
No, it's never happened. And I think many migraine sufferers will tell you that it is not a period of stress, fortunately, that causes a migraine. It's more a period after the stress. I knew when I went into surgery, I knew from my past experience that I could count on the fact that I would never get a headache when I absolutely could not tolerate to have a headache during a large final, organic chemistry final, or during an operation that was particularly stressful. But I could count on, after a stressful experience, having potentially a headache afterwards. And so it's those sorts of things, being able to learn the what affects you and what doesn't affect you, true of any pain patient, particularly migraine sufferers, you begin to adapt your life according to what you know from past experiences, how that pain has affected you. I knew from adolescence on into medical school that the migraines had never affected me during a period of time when I just could not afford to have it affect me. It would affect me maybe an hour or two later, but not during the period of time when I needed to be functional.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Frank Vrtacic is the author of Why We Hurt, The Natural History of Pain. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new CD paying tribute to Bill Monroe. This is Fresh Air.